Well, good afternoon. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls. We have with us a very special guest, really one of my favorite authors. His name is Joseph Bodansky, and I've read three of his books. The Target America, the book Bin Laden, the Man Who Declared War on America, and The High Cost of Peace. But today we're going to be talking about his latest book, The Secret History of the Iraq War. And I will tell you, this is one of the most fascinating books, and Mr. Bodansky seems to crystallize very, very clearly a lot of the things I think, but I can't articulate quite as well as he does. Mr. Bodansky, thank you so much for being with us.
A pleasure.
Now, you have been with the Republican Task Force, or head of the Republican Task Force on Terrorism and Unconventional Warfare. Are you still with them?
Well, I've been the director of the Congressional Task Force on Terrorism and Unconventional Warfare for about 16 years, and currently the whole task force is being reorganized, so we'll see. I haven't decided.
All right. Well, I hope you will at least continue doing your research and studying. And, of course, this book goes into the background of the events that led up to the situation that is developing in Iraq today. And, of course, where do you get the information on the conversations, the meetings that were held by Saddam and his family and the various Arab groups in the Middle East? You must have an amazing wealth of information coming in from all over.
Well, as I described, the vast majority of the information in the book comes from sources, indigenous sources in the Middle East, i.e. Iraqis, other Arabs, other Muslim countries, Israel, and some of the intelligence services that have on-the-ground presence in Iraq and in the Middle East, something that we do not have. And I think that Israel, Russia, the United Kingdom are probably have the best presence in the region.
And I noticed you even had quotations from the Lebanese intelligence service. So these people are doing what the American CIA has not done, and that is really have infiltrated these other countries and getting the information out on the events that led us into the tragic situation we're there now.
The Middle East is very, very talkative. There's a culture of discussion, of conversation, of reaching consensus in the political Middle East that goes all the way to the top. So if you're trusted, they'll talk to you. They'll explain, they'll justify, they'll articulate why they're doing this and that and that, and they include the worst of the enemies of the United States because they want to make sure that their message is clear to us. Our great, great problem as far as intelligence community of the United States is that we're not on the ground. We're not there. We're not conversing with anybody. And as a result of it, we're essentially blind.
All right, fine. Well, we're going to have to take a quick break here. And when we get back, I really want to get into a lot of the things that led up to the Iraqi war, things that the American people have never heard. And that's really why this is such an important book, to give you an overview of what Saddam was saying, of what the other countries over there are thinking, why they were frightened to death to have America invade Iraq, because it would destabilize that entire area. We'll be back in just a moment here with our special guest, Mr. Joseph Bodansky. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to the hills, view from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay. And of course, Mr. Bedansky is in charge of the Congressional Task Force on Terrorism and Unconventional Warfare for many years. He's written a number of books, 7 or 8 altogether, and we've just mentioning, of course, the one that I remember so well was Target America, and then, of course, more recently, Bin Laden, the man who declared war against America, The High Cost of Peace, but his latest book, The Secret History of the Iraq War. And would you like to just develop this idea a little bit, that certainly the Arab nations over there, the leaders of the Arab nations, were frightened about America invading Iraq because they figured that this might destabilize the whole area and allow these radical Islamic fundamentalists to come to power and threaten their rule. Would that be a fair statement?
It would be a fair statement, and let me use a metaphor that one of my friends in the region used. He said, Iraq is essentially like a bottle full of evil genie, because it's an artificial state. The nations and the ethnical group and the religious group inside Iraq never wanted to live together, and for the last 80 years essentially have been terrorized into coexisting inside the borders of Iraq, but that did not create a nation. Saddam Hussein was the cork that was keeping that bottle closed. Yes, Saddam Hussein was evil. Yes, Saddam Hussein was destabilizing the region. Yes, Saddam Hussein had to go. But when we removed him, the bottle was open, the genies were out. What we've been warned again and again by our friends and enemies and everybody who talk to us in the period leading to the war is, you want to remove the cork? No problem. The cork really needs to go. But find another cork to put it on the bottle before the genies are out. We were, I think, like in fairy tales. We thought that the genies would be grateful for us for releasing them from out of the bottle. Not the case.
And, of course, you have the Kurds, you have your Sunni Muslims, you have your Shia Muslims, and, of course...
And they're divided into tribes and sub-tribes and ethnical groups that hate each other with passion, not just across the confessional divide.
And
the Kurds are divided, the Turkmens and Assyrians, and it's a mess.
Well, we're going to have to take a break here in just a moment. But when we get back, I'd like to talk a little bit about Iran, because, of course, in many of your books, you've emphasized what most people don't understand. One of the major dangers is Iran. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this afternoon is Joseph Bedansky. We're talking about his book, The Secret History of the Iraq War. And, of course, the part that points you make so well is that certainly the Ayatollahs in Iran intend to use the American invasion, if they can, then to unite with the Shia Muslims and the Ayatollahs in Iraq. And this will be a very much of a destabilizing process. There's no way we can have democratic elections in Iraq, because if we do, the Shia Muslims will take over simply because of their numbers. So why do we keep talking about democracy? Well, our leaders have to be smart enough to realize that one man, one vote, one time, and that would be an institution of another Muslim state, a Muslim theocracy.
There were people, myself included, who warned the White House in the fall of 2002 that if we promise democracy, or if we promise that we're going to liberation to the Iraqi population, they will interpret it in terms that we will regret, but the White House went out and did what they did, and we paid the price. Now, as far as Iran goes, Iran today is at a fork, kind of at the top of it, the T in the road. If the United States succeed in Iraq, we will, in a sense, complete the encirclement of Iran with hostile powers, and the mullahs in Tehran know that their regime will, within a short time, stifle and die out. On the other hand, if they win in Iraq, and Iraq becomes a Shiite-dominated country, or is fractured, and there are Kurdish and Shiite-dominated parts of Iraq, Iran will be on the road to the greatest triumph of the Persian nation since the days of Cyrus the Great, which is the 7th century B.C. The Persians or the Iranians will be able to build a Shiite bridge using the Shiites of Iraq, the Shiite of Syria, the Alawites, who are in control, and of course the Shiite of Lebanon, Hezbollah, etc., to reach the Mediterranean, something they haven't done in 2,500 years. The Shiites will be able to control or to exacerbate the Shiites of the eastern part of the Arabian Peninsula, who are sitting over the oil, and as a result of it, Iran will be in control of 85% to 90% of the oil of the Middle East, and by comparison, we went to war in 1990 when Saddam controlled 38% to 40% of the oil. And last but not least, in historically, the center of Shiite Islam politically was in Najaf, Iraq. In the late 70s, because of the Khomeini Revolution and Saddam's oppression of the Shiites, the center moved to Qom in Iran, and as a result of it gave the mullah's regime tremendous amount of influence over the entire Muslim world. One of the things that started in the aftermath of the collapse of Saddam Hussein is the beginning of a slide of leading mullahs, including Khomeini's grandson, back to Najaf in the hope of restoring the old center in Najaf. Tehran cannot afford that. That will be the end of the legitimacy of the regime. And therefore, the mullahs are going to fight a war by proxy against us in Iraq, because for them it's a difference between death and a historical triumph. And the people who gave us Beirut and terrorism, etc., are not going to sit idly by and wait for us to succeed in Tehran and destroy the regime.
And, of course, when you say that what happened in Beirut, you're speaking of a Hezbollah, that, of course, was behind the bombing of the embassy there and then of the Marine barracks back in 1983.
And the hostage taking and other acts of terrorism.
Right. And, of course, the thing is, we should have interfered a long time ago, at least let Iran know we were not going to put up with that. And we consistently sort of let them get away with it until we come to a crisis position today where Iran is on the verge, or, as you mentioned in one of your books, they already have some nuclear weapons which they've actually bought on the market, and they're trying to get to a point where they can actually produce them as well. Is that correct?
That's correct. Iranian purchased their three-cycle of purchasing. The first from former Soviet Union, the first two from former Soviet Union, the second one were upgraded by the North Koreans, and the third was probably from North Korea. The working assumption is that Iran is a nuclear power. They're definitely behaving as one, and the whole crisis that exists today with the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Association, is the Iranian reminding us, without declaring that they are nuclear power, that they have nuclear capabilities. The same thing applies to the testing and moving around of ballistic missiles. Again, these are quiet reminders, but very, very clear, that Iran has the capabilities and the willpower to use their weapons of mass destruction in order to deter a U.S. invasion of Iran.
And, of course, they have the intermediate-range missiles, and which they're getting from, of course, North Korea, which got the technology from Russia, which got the technology, I believe, from us. And so we have created, in many respects, a really serious enemy that has a different philosophy. And you point out in your book that the philosophy of the Muslim is they want to die for Allah. This is the greatest thing they can have. Americans want to live. Well, I mean, we're willing to fight, but we want to live, and they want to die. How do you fight somebody like that?
Well, Muslim society is very complex. It's not monolithic, and there are several. An individual has several identities. One of them is the tribal extended family, the localized, the subnational identity. And within that level of leadership, the leader, the head of the family, head of the clan, is obliged to the well-being of those underneath him. And that makes these people susceptible to cooperation with the West, because we can provide something that nobody else can. Foreign aid, technology, assistance in the improvement of the lot of their people, and therefore their own empowerment. We need to work with these elements in society and convince them that it is in their vested interest to suppress the Islamist, jihadist, terrorist in their midst in order to do better to their own population and rise in power against those in comparison with those living next to them. But it is an extremely difficult undertaking because, A, we need to understand each and every clan, and they are different, they are not carbon copy. And number two, the common denominator of all of these subnational entities is the fact that they resent the existence of a nation state, and right now we are committed to Iraq as a nation state rather than the breakup of the country to small sub-identities.
But, of course, what about this radical Islamic belief, or maybe the fundamental Islamic belief, is what we ought to refer to it, these beliefs to go back to the time of the Prophet, where they spread their beliefs by the sword, and it was a great honor to die for Allah. Isn't this one of the things that threatens...
It is there, and it is growing, and it's fast becoming the mainstream opinion or state of mind throughout the Muslim world. But this has not been the case until recently.
Well, don't you think that our invasion of Iraq has actually promoted this far better, more efficiently than anything Osama bin Laden could ever have done?
Oh, I'm not quoting in the book, The Secret History of the Iraq War, one of the luminaries of Islam saying that Bush could not have done, could not have given bin Laden a better gift than the invasion of Iraq, because for the Muslim world this is a replay of the crisis of 1258-1260 that started with the sacking and the destruction of Baghdad, but ended up with the spread of Islam, the beginning of the spread of Islam into Central Asia all the way to the Philippines, which was the largest territorial and demographic spread of Islam. So people are flocking into Iraq to be part of that replay of the historic turning point of Islam, and everybody is eager to die as a martyr in order to further that turning point. And we should have known that, but we ignored that.
Well, the thing that I think is so important for our American listeners to think of, I mean, we think in terms of weeks and months and years and maybe decades, but the Arab mind thinks in terms of centuries and millennia. And, you know, they're going back to the time of the Crusades in the 1200s. And, you know, Tehran wants, of course, to, gain the property that they had hundreds and hundreds of years ago, or regain that property. And the Americans just don't understand the mindset of the people. Would that be a fair statement to make?
Yes, absolutely. And you get it when you sit and you talk to them, and be it heads of state, a senior official in who are totally westernized, been educated in the United States or in the West, etc., and good people, very good people, highly educated, very sophisticated in Western terms. And they are alluding, they're bringing back the historical precedent as if it was yesterday. And things that happened in the region 500, 700, 1,000 years ago are as much a factor in their decision-making about ongoing political issues as things that happened in the United States yesterday. And sometimes, and many times, the historical input is far more important, overrides impact of something that the President of the United States or Congress or some other leaders in, say, Western Europe have done or said. And unless you sit and you experience it, it's very difficult to comprehend that this is a completely different state of mind.
One of the things that really intrigued me in your book, you were talking about all these terrorist cells. There's some like special forces troops that Saddam Hussein had, and he was sending them, not only to the adjacent countries there in the Middle East, but to Europe, and some of them were even sent to the United States. But they were never activated to carry out their terrorist acts. And when we get back from my break, I hope maybe you'll discuss that as to why they weren't, and why these terrorists, well-trained, very efficient terrorists, did not actually take action here in the United States at the time that the United States attacked Iraq. And we'll be back in just a moment. Our special guest is Mr. Joseph Badansky, who is the chairman of the Congressional Task Force for Terrorism and Non-Conventional Warfare, one of the most fascinating writers you'll ever hope to read. We do carry his book, Bin Laden, The Man Who Declared War Against America, and we can get this one for you as well. It's The Secret History of the Iraq War.
Have you ever wondered what the Vietnamese War was really all about? Why America, the most powerful nation in the world, spent 10 years fighting in Southeast Asia against a nation the size of the state of Mississippi, and America lost that war? Do you really believe that happened by accident? There's so much to the story of Vietnam that the American people have never really known. And in our four-tape set, Vietnam, The Untold Story, you're going to get the information that you need to understand the tragedy of that event. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and ask for Vietnam, The Untold Story, the story of what really happened in Vietnam that has been suppressed from the American people for the last 20 years.
This is health journalist Bill Sardi. In the 1970s, there was a group of Italian immigrants in the small town of Rosetto, Pennsylvania, who drew worldwide attention for their unusual cardiovascular health, despite their pasta diets. I recently uncovered the fact that their unusual health was attributed to the precious red wine which they imported from Italy. Today we know this as the French paradox, the fact that the French exhibit greater cardiovascular health despite their fatty diet because of the red wine they drink. Wouldn't it be great to enjoy the health benefits of red wine without the calories, alcohol, and sulfite preservatives? Well, now you can with Longevinex, the world's first stabilized red wine molecules preserved in an airtight capsule just like in a sealed bottle of red wine, equivalent to 5 glasses of the best red wine. Call 866-405-4000 to order Longevinex for healthy aging without the calories and alcohol. 866-405-4000.
This leading-edge dentists know the profound effect dental materials and procedures have on the health of the entire body. If you've been searching for a holistic trained dentist who can safely treat you, look no further. Dr. David Biles has been a leader in the Santa Cruz dental community for nearly 20 years. He built a solid reputation providing exceptionally high-quality cosmetic and restorative dental care long before learning the very real hazards of common dental practices. Now, as a faculty member of the Institute of Natural Dentistry, Dr. Biles has begun lecturing nationally to other dentists on alternative and complementary dental care. On request, Dr. Biles will safely remove toxic dental materials from your mouth while substituting them with safe, non-allergenic restorations. Call Dr. Biles today and take the next step to improve your health. With sedation and nitrous oxide available, Dr. Biles can help even the most anxious patients. Call 423-0121 and schedule a visit now. That's 423-0121.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and a few weeks ago, Kevin DeMeritt of Lear Financial contacted us and asked if he could sponsor some of our programs. Well, I looked into the background of the company. They have an excellent reputation, so I think it's a good time to think very seriously about investing in precious metals. Why? Because we have inflation, we have a progressively devalued dollar, that we've lost almost 30-40% of our value of our currency, and we know that people like Warren Buffett are investing overseas. They're not investing in American currencies. Why not give the people at Lear Financial a call at 1-888-302-7111, that's 1-888-302-7111, and ask for their free audio seminar. Again, the number 1-888-302-7111. I think this is an excellent time to consider protecting your assets. And this is Dr. Stan, and I just want to mention that Radio Liberty does carry the Miracle 2 soap products, and just give us a call and inquire about them. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest this afternoon is Joseph Podansky. And, of course, we're talking about his amazing book. He's got more information in this. It's a very long book, but it's well worthwhile reading. It reads almost like a novel as this whole story of the impending war comes about. The secret history of the Iraq War and the information why Rush Limbaugh and Bill O'Reilly are never going to tell you. But I was asking before we went to the break, why was it that these terrorist cells that would actually infiltrate the United States and Western Europe, we're never given the order to actually attack?
This is one of the mysteries of the war, but it's part of a larger mystery. The Saddam Hussein, until a few weeks before the U.S. actually invaded, was wavering between a defensive strategy, which he implemented, i.e. to absorb the U.S. strike hold for as long as he could, and then transform the war into a guerrilla warfare of the kind that we're still facing and is still escalating in Iraq, or an offensive strategy which he conspired together with Syria, Iran, and Yasser Arafat to launch a preemptive strike against Israel that will immediately engulf the entire Middle East in flames, will force all Arab countries to side with him against Israel, and in so doing essentially prevent the United States from using any base or infrastructure in the region. Therefore, the U.S. would not be able to attack Iraq while for as long as the conflagration against Israel was unfolding. The dispatch of terrorists into the heart of the United States, as well as Western Europe and other Middle Eastern countries, was part of that offensive strategy, i.e. revenge. The terrorist strikes were to be presented as, or justified as, part of the revenge against the U.S. support for Israel or U.S. aggression in the Middle East. The moment Saddam embarked on a defensive strategy, there was no need to activate these cells, and therefore they've never been activated.
All right.
As the cells in the United States, terrorist cells in the United States, we've been warned in the book. I describe it, attribute the warning to friendly intelligence services. Recently, President Putin of Russia publicly acknowledged that Russia was the source that provided us with the best warning about the presence of terrorists in our midst. Once deactivated, these terrorists just wavered away. With the fall of Baghdad, the individual went their own way.
Now, one of the things you bring out so well in your book is the fact that Saddam really did have weapons of mass destruction. Everybody, of course, is golfing and said, oh, the president was so wrong. But there really were weapons of mass destruction. There were chemical, there were biological weapons, and most of them were moved into Syria, weren't they?
Yes, they were. Saddam had an operational arsenal, I mean, battlefield arsenal, not production capabilities. These were moved to Sudan and Libya in the late 1990s. And again, the moment Saddam decided against for defensive strategy, the majority of the weapons were moved to Syria in several phases. The book goes into excruciating details in describing A, how the weapons were evacuated, and number two, where they are today, in which units and installation of the Syrian armed forces are keeping what part of the Iraqi arsenal. The rest of the weapons are stored in a few North Korean-built bunkers that are deep underground facilities that we know from people who've been inside what's in these bunkers, but we really don't know where they are, and this is one of the enduring great mysteries of the war.
All right, fine. Will you be able to stay with us for the next half hour?
Sure.
All right, fine. Well, I'm looking forward to it. And so, basically, those weapons of mass destruction are real. I don't know whether the Bush administration is miraculously going to find them just before the election, you know, that would give a big boost to the polls, or who knows what's going to happen. But certainly, Mr. Podansky, with great details, goes into these weapons of mass destruction, which we've confirmed by talking to Dor Gold, a former Israeli ambassador to Saudi Arabia, pardon me, to the United Nations, and other very responsible people. But you're not hearing this, you see. And this book has the information you're not getting elsewhere through regular channels. And this is the advantage to reading the book, The Secret History of the Iraq War, because you're going to find out, for instance, that Saddam Hussein was even thinking about going into exile. But, of course, it was almost appear that we didn't want him to go into exile because you're going to have to listen to the next half hour, because I want Mr. Podansky to describe the offers were made for him to go into exile, and how, in effect, the United States toppled those. We could have had the whole thing. We could have replaced him without a war. It seemed that there were people who were intent upon a war. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty.
Our that four-tape set on the JFK assassination includes an interview with Lee Harvey Oswald. Of course, it's not an interview that I did, but it is an interview, and you'll actually hear Lee Harvey Oswald talking before the time of the assassination. A two-hour interview with Colonel Fletcher Prouty, who was the liaison between the Pentagon and the CIA at the time of the assassination of the American president. And then, of course, my overall analysis of the reasons why President Kennedy was assassinated. There's so much information that has not been put out. And if you listen to this four-tape set, you will begin to understand that there are forces at work behind the scenes which have been able to confuse the American people about the reality of the murder of an American president. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, that's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and ask for the JFK assassination tapes.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. I just want to tell you a little bit about Miracle 2 soap products. Now, we can't make any medical claims for them at all, but we can tell you that an awful lot of people who use them really tell us amazing, amazing stories. I had one gentleman call me within the last month who said he'd had psoriasis all of his life, tried all the salves and lotions, and nothing seemed to help it. And once he got started using Miracle 2, he was really so much better. I've heard this from a number of people, actually, since that time. We have people who've had rashes, some of the veterans. I know that Joyce Riley gives the Miracle 2 products to a lot of veterans, provides them for them, actually free of charge, that she does that, and we support what she does. But anyway, these are people who are over in Vietnam, and they have the rashes, and nothing helps them, and they seem to get better. We had a fellow right here, locally, who had a rash, who actually was sent up to Stanford. Nobody could figure out what to do for it. Within 2 weeks on the Miracle 2 soap products, why the rash was gone. Now, I don't know whether it helped him or not, but I'll tell you one thing, and that he's not willing to stop using it. And, of course, he uses the neutralizer, which is a very alkaline solution. And, of course, some people take that for their upper gastrointestinal tract, and others take it for the lower gastrointestinal tract. And then, of course, he's probably using the gel, which I use regularly. I wouldn't be without my moisturizing soap, and my wife gives me the neutralizing solution. Whether it helps or not, I don't know, but I'm pretty healthy for 75. And then, of course, we hope that many of you will give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. The one thing I can tell you is it's awfully good soap, and the gel just has many, many uses. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. There's a soap, a moisturizing soap, a lotion, a gel, and a neutralizing solution. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest this afternoon is Mr. Josef Badansky, his book, The Secret History of the Iraq War. And if you really want to get the background of what led into this, why a fascinating source of information, would you like to talk a little bit about the fact that at one point Saddam seemed to be actually considering going into exile, and they were even building some sort of a place for him over there in Libya, where he and all of his advisors could go, and it would have avoided the war and the bloodshed and the horror and the chaos that we've gotten into over there?
Well, both Russia and the Arab, and many Arab leaders were convinced that it would be possible to replace Saddam with, as I described, a different cog, would keep the evil genies of, demonic genies of Iraq still bottled. And Arabs and Russian emissaries have negotiated and discussed the issue with Saddam. And at the end, I think that the Russians reached the conclusion that that a coup in Iraq was possible, and were working toward that end until we betrayed them.
And we betrayed the Russians, who were trying to come up with a peaceful solution.
The Russians came up with the idea to have a coup, and Russia and Israel have the best non-Arab presence in Iraq. So the Russians had a relationship and contact. They started thinking about a coup, replacing Saddam with somebody who will keep Iraq pacified. They knew that we were interested in the situation in Iraq, and therefore they notified us that what they were doing to make sure that they don't harm by accident any one of our assets, I would say non-existing assets in Baghdad at the time. The White House, the Bush administration got so alarmed by the idea that the Russian will be able to take credit for the toppling of Saddam, that the CIA told the Egyptian intelligence about the Russian plans with the full knowledge that the Egyptian will rush and tell their Iraqi friends, and so it was, and the Russians pulled out. The other Arab friends tried to negotiate a variety of ideas with Saddam Hussein, and told on the eve of the war, the Iraqis were making signs that they were willing to consider some kind of a deal that will save Saddam's honor and at the same time will essentially remove him from power. I don't know to what extent Saddam was genuine in his negotiations, or Saddam's emissaries were genuine and honest in their negotiations. My Arab friends assure me that there was something to talk about, but one thing to be certain, Washington would hear nothing of that and warned anybody who would listen or would not listen that the United States was adamant on removing Saddam Hussein its own way, and indeed we did.
Yeah, and we did, and what we've done is we've created a situation where, in many respects, America is sort of the laughing stock over there. Oh, yes, we are going to install a new government, but what we did is we had to back down in Fallujah, and a lot of the people, a lot of the Arab governments over there that look to America as a stabilizing force, now, you point out in your conclusion, are beginning to look to the Islamic radicals, saying, well, maybe we better make accommodation with them, because obviously we can't trust America. America wasn't really able to pacify. America's had to make concessions. America's had to back down. We don't look very good to the surrounding countries, do we?
No, we're not. And a friend of mine I talked to last week about the new Iraqi government summed it up, I think, better than anybody else. He said, you Americans, you bribe. The Islamists extort and kill. And in this world, fear is far, far stronger than greed.
And I really think that it's really such a tragic situation that they came in. It was a wonderful war, which just won it within just a relatively few weeks. The trouble was
even that was, I think that had it not, the book goes in. The book describes what the military situation, and had it not been for some real deadly mistakes committed by Qusay Saddam Hussein when he took over the handling of the war, our rush to Baghdad would not, or race to Baghdad would not have been as smooth and as fast as it happened. Had the Iraqis stuck to the defense plan of Baghdad as designed by Soviet experts during the 1980s and 90s, we would have been embarrassed.
Now, why didn't Saddam use his chemical and biological warfare? Because he had it there, he had the shells, he was prepared to use it. There, people had their chemical and biological warfare defense. Why didn't he use the chemical and biological warfare that he intended to?
He had the capability to have the more. He had two types of weapons to be used. One, artillery, including rockets, to be used against advancing U.S. forces, and then buried weapons to be used as mines or with sabotage charges in the so-called red line surrounding Baghdad. The Iraqis that I talked to in the aftermath of the war said that the military was dead set against, except for the Fedayeen Saddam, against the use of chemical weapons against the advancing American forces the moment they realized that the U.S. forces were unstoppable, and they knew that there were some casualties, but our wrath will be detrimental to their ability to survive. As far as by the time that Saddam, the U.S. forces reached the red line, Saddam has realized that what's really important was a popular guerrilla war, the long-term protracted guerrilla warfare that he has planned for a long, long time. And he and his advisors concluded, and I think rightly so, that using chemical weapons in urban environment would create tremendous amount of casualties among Iraq's Arabs, and that the popular hostility or resentment, outrage, I should say, from such an act that they have, and the heavy casualties, will push the population into the fold of the U.S. occupation forces and away from Saddam and the guerrilla warfare. And what was important for Saddam is to have as much popular resentment of the U.S. occupation, and that's why they ransacked Baghdad immediately after we took hold of it, and sending that sent the population into the fold of the resistance, where Saddam made the mistake, and here I'm encapsulating probably half of the book in one sentence, is that he did not realize that the population would transform into Islamist and nationalist sentiments rather than pro-Saddam Hussein.
Well, now,
as a result of it, we have today an indigenous grassroots population that is Islamist and nationalist, not Saddamist.
Well, now, would you call these people Islamists? In other words, are they going over to this radical form of Islam?
Yes.
Or is this increasingly in the general Islamic, general Iraqi population?
There is an Islamicization of the Iraqi population. Fighters in the Fallujah area and the Sunni heartland that started the war as drinking, smoking, secularized military personnel now feature beards or mustaches. They stop drinking, they stop smoking, they return to Islam as a source of identity and mental strength that enabled them to endure a year of fighting against us. There is an Islamicization of society, which is one of the most profound changes in Iraqi society during the war.
But,
and that applies to the Kurds, to the Turkmen, to the Sunnis, and to the Shiites.
But because this is
the board.
But this is happening also in Turkey, where the radical Islamists won the last election. Isn't it happening in Saudi Arabia and the other adjacent countries? In other words, hasn't our invasion over there really brought about this radical form of Islam? We talked about that in the first half hour, but this is the real danger to all the existing states over there, other than Iran, isn't it?
Yes, and our invasion of Iraq accelerated a process that was unfolding. Saudi Arabia has been in the throes of radical Islam for a long time, with the royal family, despite all of its corruption, or irrespective of its corruption and self-serving policies, was still trying to somehow bottle and contain the rest of Islam from spreading in Saudi Arabia. Now, using bases inside Iraq, the Islamists were able to flare up Saudi Arabia to the point that the royal family's hold over Saudi Arabia is tenuous at best.
Well, do you think that the royal family is going to be able to hang on, or do you think they're going to pack up their suitcases full of money and head off to Switzerland?
Well, some will head up to Switzerland. What I'm far more afraid of is that those who would like to hold on to power will make deals with the Bin Ladens of the world on power sharing at our expense.
And, of course, if they can, of course, control the oil that's there, are they going to have a profound impact on our economy? Would that be a fair statement?
Yes, but and in that respect, as I said at the beginning of the program, I'm far more afraid of the Shiites taking hold of our of the oil than the Bin Ladens of the world, but that is really trying to distinguish between shades of black. Either way, we're going to be in a bad situation, because the Europeans are going to make deals with the Arabs in order to ensure the continuation of the flow of oil. The Japanese will make deal with the Islamists to ensure the flow of oil, and all of it will come at the expense of our global and economic interests.
And, of course, the Chinese communists as well, won't they?
They've already made the deals, and they're helping the Islamists through North Korea and Pakistan.
What about the threat of Tehran, of Iran? Because they are now really a nuclear power I don't know how long range their missiles are, but certainly with the shipping such as
parts of Europe. They cover Israel, they can hit parts of Europe.
And, of course, by ship, they could get awfully close over here, couldn't they?
Sure, yeah. Then, they can sail a ship and blow it up in the middle of a port, an American port, without any problem.
How soon do you think that they will be able to actually produce their own nuclear weapons? You mentioned that they have several that they purchased on the open market, which nobody mentioned.
Your guess is as good as anybody, because they have... every time we find... You think our number one problem is that we really, really don't know what's happening inside Iran. The country that knows is Russia, and we're making their life miserable as far as presence in Iran, and therefore the level of knowledge is on the decline. The Iranians are running their nuclear programs in bits and pieces spread all over the country. So every now and then we discover another bit, and there is a tendency in Washington to assume that if we don't know about the existence of another part of the program, it doesn't exist. But my approach is that if we don't know about another part of the program, we don't know. It doesn't mean that that it doesn't exist. It means that we don't know about it.
I do have a feeling that sometimes in Washington, D.C., where I know you've lived for a long period of time, there's just this optimism, almost like putting your head into the ground like the ostrich does?
Ostrich position is a standard operating procedure in Washington, but it's part of it. There is a tendency in Washington to push major decisions until the last moment and beyond that. There is a reluctance to tackle major decisions, especially that the implementation of which, a solution for which, a long-term, complicated undertaking. I think that had we not been struck by the Washington, it doesn't matter which administration it is, would have been very reluctant to commit to an all-out war against international terrorism.
But of course, the thing is that instead of going after and finishing off the battle in Afghanistan with al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden, we suddenly shifted our whole emphasis over to Iraq, and even though, as you pointed out, there may have been a relationship between al-Qaeda and Iraq, this was not the major threat to America, was it? A direct threat to our country?
Our main error, I think, in embarking on... Well, the two errors. Number one is that we moved far, far, far too quickly. We should have get organized, tried to improve our intelligence, get our armed forces in shape, because right now they're strained to the point of collapse, and that's a little war in Iraq. Number two, there was a great debate in Washington whether Pakistan was part of the problem or part of the solution. And Pakistan is the problem. Afghanistan is a non-country. It's a barren land with a few camps stuck in between. Had we been really serious about it, we should have gone and cleaned up the Pakistani challenge. But Pakistan is, of course, a nuclear-armed country with China as its strategic overlord, strategic protege. So politically, it was impossible to tackle the Pakistani. So we played around in Afghanistan, and we killed a few, we destroyed a few, we scattered a few, we captured a few. No big deal. We're stuck with Pakistan, where that still gives shelter to Bin Laden and his band of merry men, and is still the source of the instability in the region. We haven't solved any problem going into Afghanistan, and then we went on, and now we took on Iraq again without realizing the dynamics of Iraq's interrelations with the Iranians, with the Syrians, with the Saudis and others. And once again, we removed Saddam and unleashed all sorts of demons without being able to solve the regional problems. All of this goes back to one thing, the horrible shape of our intelligence. Our intelligence services were unable, or community was unable, to provide the President of the United States with a coherent threat assessment, threat analysis. This is the situation in the region that you want to operate, Mr. President. These are going to be the ramifications of what you do or don't do. These are the better way to do it in order to minimize the long-term consequences of steps that need to be undertaken, of policies that need to be implemented, and will be paid the price for that for a long, long time.
The Mossad, the Israeli intelligence, is an excellent intelligence. Why don't we use their intelligence when ours is obviously failing?
The book describes the Israelis have raised issues with us over the months leading to the war and since the war, and we decided that we know better.
Well, I think that sometimes there's just too much ego and not a willingness, of course, to look to your natural allies. Mr. Bedansky, we're out of time. It's been a fascinating hour. But thank you so very much. I really appreciate
it's
having you.
It's been a pleasure.
Good. Bye-bye, and thank you so very much. Again, the book is The Secret History of the Iraq War. Can they get it any bookstore?
Any bookstore, Amazon, etc. I think it's all over the place.
It's an excellent book. Thank you so very much. God bless you, sir.
Thank you.
Anglo-American establishment gives you the documentation for Professor Quigley's allegation that there was a secret society created in England that ultimately came to dominate England and ultimately came to dominate the United States of America. The Anglo-American establishment will give you the books that you can read, written by men who were actually involved in the original secret society. Professor Quigley opens his book saying that most people have heard of the Rhodes Scholarships, and most people, a few people, have actually heard that Cecil Rhodes wrote a confession of faith, which was attached to his first five wills, talking about the formation of a secret society. But what almost no one in America realizes today is that that secret society was actually formed and still exists to this very day. The Anglo-American Establishment by Professor Quigley, Bill Clinton's mentor, is one of the most important books you'll ever read, and available by calling 1-800-5-HIV-WAR.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Let me just mention that we do carry the Robinson Homeschool curriculum, and if you are thinking seriously about homeschooling, let me recommend this to you. Art Robinson, Dr. Art Robinson, was a professor down at USC. His wife is a professor there, too, and they got sick and tired of just playing the games that you have to play in universities, so they picked up with their six children and moved up to Oregon. Mrs. Robinson put together this excellent program to raise their six children, had it all on CDs, and unfortunately she passed away, and so Art had to raise his six children by himself, but using this wonderful program she put together. And you'll actually find all of the textbooks there, except for the Saxon math books, but all of the textbooks and all of the lecture plans and all of the tests and all of the answers to the test, everything is there on those 22 CDs. And the program that will take your children from grammar school to high school graduation is $199.95. And we put this out, and we have an awful lot of people who have really been very happy with it. Now, you know, we don't want your child on the computer. Whether they get to be 16 or 18 or something like that, before they start playing with the computer and getting all the things that they're there, the whole idea of the computer is this is so that you can pull down off the CDs and get the plans and everything that's there. When Dr. Robinson's two eldest sons graduated, my understanding is they went right into the third year of college because they were so far ahead of all the other children who are going into college. And so many of our children have to go into college and take bonehead English or bonehead math, and you don't have to if you take the maximum. The homeschool curriculum, if you care about your children, there's any way you can homeschool them. Get them out of government schools because they're after their minds, their hearts, and their souls, and they'll turn them against you. They really will. Call us at 1-800-544-8927 and ask about the Robinson homeschool curriculum. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when I have to remind our listeners out across America that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we're really dependent on those of you who listen to our programs and believe, as I do, that we're involved in a spiritual battle being played out on a political and ideological battlefield. We have to depend on you for your support, and we hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, or at least subscribing to our newsletter. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927 if you'd like to subscribe to our newsletter. And then, of course, we do hope that many of you will want to get some of the various books we have, we have book foundations, their power and influence, that goes into the background of the great tax-exempt foundations. and their subversive influence in America. In fact, Professor Quigley, who was Bill Clinton's mentor, in his classic book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, which was so good that somebody bought up the Macmillan Company that had published the book and destroyed the place to the first half of the book so it could never be republished. But Professor Quigley talked about this book, Foundations, Their Power and Influence, the Reese Committee investigation of the great tax-exempt foundations, and how, of course, it's revealed what the elite never wanted you to know, and that who is financing communism and socialism in America. It's not financed by the downtrodden. It's financed by this elite group. He refers to it as the Anglo-American establishment. And these are the people who want to change our form of government to where all power comes from Washington, D.C., because they're going to control it. Because we have the finest politicians in Washington, D.C. today that money can buy. So you need to get the book, Foundations, Their Power and Influence. You can get it by itself. You can get it as part of the Tragedy and Hope special. You can get Professor Quigley's 1,342-page book. And if you read that through, you'll know most more history than the average college professor. You even get the special. You get the Tragedy and Hope. You get the Foundations, Their Power and Influence. And you get the interview with Professor Quigley where he tells you about these crazy right-wingers. And he tells you how his book was suppressed. All sorts of fascinating things. An important part of history. It's the only interview with Professor Quigley that I know that's readily available today. Then, of course, we have a wonderful video. It's called The Brotherhood of Darkness. You can get the book. But it goes into the spiritual struggle. We have a new video out that's called They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll. And you can get the 4-hour or the 10-hour version of that. And, of course, you'll actually hear the rock and roll stars talking about how they sold their souls to the devil. Most people don't believe the devil is real. Well, I can tell you he is real, and he has his dominions working right here in our society, and some of them are working right at the highest levels of our government. But They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll is an amazing video, either the 4 or the 10-hour version. And, of course, we have another new a video. It's called The Gods of Entertainment by Carol Matriciana. Well, you see that wonderful interview with Mel Gibson and Diane Sawyer, where, of course, Mel has been talking about the dark forces that are trying to keep his film, The Passion, from coming out. And Diane Sawyer asks, well, what do these dark forces want? And Mel Gibson's answer there is worth the entire price of the video. But you'll find out, of course, that the motivation of Hollywood is not necessarily money, although most people think it is. But the people who really wield the power there have a different agenda. And so that's the Gods of Entertainment and the Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll, my video. The new video is, of course, Iraq, The Road to World War III. And then, of course, we have my classic video, Iraq, The Untold Story, Brotherhood of Darkness, the interview with Professor Sutton, The Best Enemies Money Could Buy, how we financed the North Vietnamese during the Vietnam War. After all, how could we keep that war going for so long? And use it, of course, to transform America. So pray for our America, pray for our leaders, our ministers, pray for revival, but please remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow, remember our number, 1-800-544-8927. Until tomorrow, may the Lord be with you.